The Foreign Policy of a Mixed Economy by Ayn Rand.
America's foreign policy is so grotesquely irrational that most people believe there must be some sensible purpose behind it. The extent of the irrationality acts as its own protection. Like the technique of the big lie, it makes people assume that so blatant an evil could not possibly be as evil as it appears to them, and therefore that somebody must understand its meaning, even though they themselves do not. The sickening generalities and contradictions cited in justification of the foreign aid program fall roughly into two categories which are offered to us simultaneously: the idealistic and the practical, or mush and fear. The idealistic arguments consist of appeals to altruism and swim out of focus in a fog of floating abstractions about our duty to support the underdeveloped nations of the entire globe who are starving and will perish without our selfless help. The practical arguments consist of appeals to fear and emit a different sort of fog, to the effect that our own selfish interest requires that we go bankrupt buying the favor of the underdeveloped nations who otherwise will become a dangerous threat to us. It is useless to point out to the advocates of our foreign policy that it's either or. Either the underdeveloped nations are so weak that they are doomed without our help, in which case they cannot become a threat to us, or they are so strong that with some other assistance they can develop to the point of endangering us, in which case we should not drain our economic power to help the growth of potential enemies who are that powerful. It is useless to discuss the contradiction between these two assertions because neither of them is true. Their proponents are impervious to fact, to logic, and to the mounting evidence that after two decades of global altruism, our foreign policy is achieving the exact opposite of its alleged goals. It is wrecking our own economy. It is reducing us internationally to the position of an impotent failure who has nothing but a series of compromises, retreats, defeats, and betrayals on his record. And instead of bringing progress to the world, it is bringing the bloody chaos of tribal warfare and delivering one helpless nation after another into the power of communism. When a society insists on pursuing a suicidal course, one may be sure that the alleged reasons and proclaimed slogans are mere rationalizations. The question is only, what is it that these rationalizations are hiding? Observe that there is no consistent pattern in the erratic chaos of our foreign aid. And although in the long run it leads to the benefit of Soviet Russia, Russia is not its direct, immediate beneficiary. There is no consistent winner, only a consistent loser, the United States. In the face of such a spectacle, most people give up the attempt to understand. Some imagine that some omnipotent conspiracy is destroying America, that the rationalizations are hiding some malevolent, fantastically powerful giant. But the truth is worse than that. The truth is that the rationalizations are hiding nothing, that there is nothing at the bottom of the fog but a nest of scurrying cockroaches. I submit in evidence an article in the editorial section of the New York Times of July 15, 1962, entitled "Role of Foreign Lobbies." I quote, "A non-diplomatic corps of foreign agents," states the article, "has bloomed in recent years in Washington. Lobbying in Congress to obtain or prevent the passage of legislation of interest to their foreign clients, seeking to pressure the administration into adopting certain political or economic policies, or attempting to mold public opinion through a myriad of methods and techniques. This legion of special agents has become an elusive shadow for operating in Washington and the width and the length of the land. Unquote. Lobbying is the activity of attempting to influence legislation by privately influencing the legislators. It is the result and creation of a mixed economy of government by pressure groups. Its methods range from mere social courtesies and cocktail party or luncheon friendships to favors, threats, bribes, blackmail. All lobbyists, whether serving foreign or domestic interests, are required by laws passed in the last 3 decades to register with the government. The registrations have been growing at such a rate, with the foreign lobbies outnumbering the domestic ones, that legislators are beginning to be alarmed. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has announced that it is preparing an investigation of these foreign agents' activities. The New York Times article describes foreign lobbying as follows. Quote, "The theory behind this whole enterprise is that for a fee or a retainer, and often for hundreds of thousands of dollars in advertising, publicity, and expense money, a foreign government or a foreign economic or political interest can purchase a favorable legislation in the United States Congress, a friendly policy of the administration, or a positive image in the eyes of the American public opinion, leading in turn to profitable political or economic advantage." Unquote. Who are these lobbyists? Men with political pull, with access to influential Washington figures, American men hired by foreign interests. The article mentions that most of these men are Washington lawyers or New York public relations firms. Russia is one of these foreign interests and is served by registered lobbyists in Washington. But she is merely cashing in on the situation like the others. The success of her conspiracy in this country is the result, not the cause, of our self-destruction. She is winning by default. The cause is much deeper than that. The issue of lobbies has attracted attention recently through the struggle of foreign lobbies to obtain sugar quotas from the American government. Quote, "Their efforts," states the article, "were centered on Representative Harold D. Cooley, Democrat of North Carolina, chairman of the House Committee on Agriculture, who at least until this year held almost the complete power in the distribution of quotas. It has never been too clear what criteria Mr. Cooley used in allocating these quotas, and by the same token, it is impossible to determine what was the actual effect of the lobbyists' entreaties on him. But in offering their services to foreign governments or sugar growers' associations, these representatives were, in effect, offering for sale their real or alleged friendship with Mr. Cooley." Unquote. This is the core and essence of the issue of lobbying and of our foreign aid and of a mixed economy. The trouble is not that it has never been too clear what criteria Mr. Cooley used in allocating these quotas, but that it has never been and never can be too clear what criteria he was expected to use by the legislation that granted him these powers. No criteria can ever be defined in this context. Such is the nature of a non-objective law and of all economic legislation. So long as a concept such as the public interest, or the social or national or international interest, is regarded as a valid principle to guide legislation, lobbies and pressure groups will necessarily continue to exist. Since there is no such entity as the public, since the public is merely a number of individuals, the idea that the public interest supersedes private interests and rights can have but one meaning, that the interests and rights of some individuals take precedence over the interests and rights of others. If so, then all men and all private groups have to fight to the death for the privilege of being regarded as the public. The government's policy has to swing like an erratic pendulum from group to group, hitting some and favoring others at the whim of any given moment, and so grotesque a profession as lobbying, selling influence, becomes a full-time job. If parasitism, favoritism, corruption, and greed for the unearned did not exist, a mixed economy would bring them into existence. Since there is no rational justification for the sacrifice of some men to others, there is no objective criterion by which such a sacrifice can be guided in practice. All public interest legislation and any distribution of money taken by force from some men for the unearned benefit of others comes down ultimately to the grant of an undefined, undefinable, non-objective, arbitrary power to some government officials. The worst aspect of it is not that such a power can be used dishonestly, but that it cannot be used honestly. The wisest man in the world, with the purest integrity, cannot find a criterion for the just, equitable, rational application of an unjust, inequitable, irrational principle. The best that an honest official can do is to accept no material bribe for his arbitrary decision, but this does not make his decision and its consequences more just or less calamitous. A man of clear-cut convictions is impervious to anyone's influence. But when clear-cut convictions are impossible, personal influences take over. When a man's mind is trapped in the foggy labyrinths of the non-objective that has no exits and no solutions, he will welcome any quasi-persuasive, semi-plausible argument. Lacking certainty, he will follow anyone's facsimile thereof. He is the natural prey of social manipulators, of propaganda salesmen, of lobbyists. When any argument is as inconclusive as any other, the subjective, emotional, or so-called human element becomes decisive. A harried legislator may conclude, consciously or subconsciously, that the friendly man who smiled at him at the cocktail party last week was a good person who would not deceive him and whose opinion can be trusted safely. It is by considerations such as these that officials may dispose of your money, your effort, and your future. Although cases of actual corruption do undoubtedly exist among legislators and government officials, they are not a major motivating factor in today's situation. It is significant that in such cases as have been publicly exposed, the bribes were almost pathetically small. Men who held the power to dispose of millions of dollars sold their favors for a $1,000 rug or a fur coat or a refrigerator. The truth, most likely, is that they did not regard it as bribery or as a betrayal of their public trust. They did not think that their particular decision could matter one way or another in the kind of causeless choices they had to make, in the absence of any criteria, in the midst of the general orgy of tossing away an apparently ownerless wealth. Men who would not sell out their country for $1 million are selling it out for somebody's smile and a vacation trip to Florida. It is of such pennies and smiles that the destruction of your country is made. The general public is helplessly bewildered. The intellectuals do not care to look at our foreign policy too closely. They feel guilt. They sense that their own worn-out ideologies, which they dare not challenge, are the cause of the consequences which they dare not face. The more they evade, the greater their eagerness to grasp at any fashionable straw or rationalization and to uphold it with glassy-eyed aggressiveness. The threadbare cloak of altruism serves to cover it up and to sanction the evasions by a fading aura of moral righteousness. The exhausted cynicism of a bankrupt culture, of a society without values, principles, convictions, or intellectual standards, does the rest. It leaves a vacuum for anyone to take over and use. The motive power behind the suicidal bleeding of the greatest country in the world is not an altruistic fervor or a collectivist crusade any longer, but the manipulations of little lawyers and public relations men pulling the mental strings of lifeless automatons. These, the lobbyists in the pay of foreign interests, the men who could not hope to get, in any other circumstances, the money they are getting now, are the real and only profiteers on the global sacrifice, as their ilk has always been at the close of every altruistic movement in history. It is not the underdeveloped nations, nor the underprivileged masses, nor the starving children of jungle villages who benefit from America's self-immolation. It is only the men who are too small to start such movements and small enough to cash in at the end. It is not any lofty ideals that the altruism-collectivism doctrine accomplishes or can ever accomplish. Its end of trail is as follows. Quote, a local railroad had gone bankrupt in North Dakota, abandoning the region to the fate of a blighted area. The local banker had committed suicide, first killing his wife and children. A freight train had been taken off the schedule in Tennessee, leaving a local factory without transportation at a day's notice. The factory owner's son had quit college and was now in jail, awaiting execution for a murder committed with a gang of raiders. A way station had been closed in Kansas, and the station agent, who had wanted to be a scientist, had given up his studies and become a dishwasher. That he, James Taggart, might sit in a private barroom and pay for the alcohol pouring down Orrin Boyle's throat, for the waiter who sponged Boyle's garments when he spilled his drink over his chest, for the carpet burned by the cigarettes of an ex-pimp from Chile who did not want to take the trouble of reaching for an ashtray across a distance of 3 feet. Unquote. From Atlas Shrugged. This is the conclusion of the article on the pool peddlers in the Objectivist newsletter of September 1962. I should like to add a few remarks. As you can observe today, and as has been remarked, the question of foreign aid is a perennial battle between the President and Congress, and this battle is being fought right now. The two parties haggle or bargain about the amounts of foreign aid involved, about money, but neither side ever challenges the basic principle behind the issue of foreign aid. The point is that there is no basic principle behind it, and neither side, neither the proponents or the opponents of foreign aid, dare face this particular fact. There is no principle behind our foreign aid. It is motivated intellectually by the worn-out, bankrupt ideological slogans and premises of collectivism and altruism, which no one, in fact, believes or takes seriously any longer. the altruist collectivist principles which have thoroughly demonstrated their impotence, their failure, and their disaster in the last 50 years, and particularly since the close of World War II. No one believes these principles any longer, but in the absence of any positive philosophy, any positive movement against the entire altruist collectivist axis, men needing a philosophy are still acting by routine, by default, on the premises of an ideology they do not believe any longer. That is the ideological background of our foreign aid policy. And when any nation, particularly one as rich and powerful as the United States, is floundering helplessly on the premise of suicide or self-looting and self-destruction, you may be sure that there will be men and groups of men who will take advantage of it. If looting collectivists did not exist, America's foreign aid policy would create them. When a country is bent on giving away its wealth and its economic power, somebody will necessarily be tempted to take advantage of it. Who then is actually profiting by this giveaway program? Mainly the kind of businessmen which are always cited as examples of the worst aspect of capitalism, but who in fact are not examples of capitalism at all. They are the products and the examples of a mixed economy. Namely, the kind of businessmen who seek to make profit by means of government action, who seek to grow rich not by means of productive ability, but by means of political pull and of special political privileges. Observe that there are firms here and there in various businesses and industries who are growing prosperous by trading with foreign countries, the specific foreign countries who receive American aid. In other words, there are businessmen who are selling their products to the foreign countries receiving American aid and who are paid by American funds, who are paid by the aid money granted to those countries. In other words, some Americans are draining the money, the tax money of other Americans into their own pockets via a long detour through every corner of the globe which receives our foreign aid. This tax money is taken from some citizens, handed to foreign governments and pressure groups, and then comes back to some of our citizens, to those successful pressure groups who have pull in Washington, who have a good lobbyist, and who succeed in maintaining the issue of foreign aid year after year and profit thereby. When men denounce profit, remember that this kind of procedure, this greed for the unearned, is the opposite of capitalism. Yet, it is capitalism that is usually blamed for actions and policies of that kind, and the solution offered is always more power to the government, more government controls, in other words, more of the poison that created the problem in the first place. The men who grow rich by siphoning tax money into their own pockets are the representatives and products of a mixed economy, not of capitalism, not of free enterprise. It is only a mixed economy that makes them possible, they would not be possible under laissez-faire capitalism. And what they represent is simply the civil war of pressure groups, which is the necessary corollary of a mixed economy, or rather the necessary expression of a mixed economy, now being carried to the international scene. It is a civil war gone international. It is pressure groups using foreign countries in order to destroy our own. That is the meaning of our foreign aid policy. Good night, ladies and gentlemen, and good premises.
For additional information about other available programs, please contact Second Renaissance at 1-800-729-6149 or at www.ayn randbookstore.com. All material in this program is protected by copyright and may not be reproduced in any form or manner, nor played before an audience, without the express written permission of the producer, Second Renaissance Incorporated.